Here's a preview from this episode.
Like, this idea of wanting is so difficult for women. And I'm sure people who are listening are like, no, it's not that hard. And then, but I go home and try and write down what you really want for yourself. The things that you have never said aloud to another person, but maybe haven't even acknowledged to yourself. This was a wall that I hit at the beginning of this process.
Before we dive into today's episode, I want you to take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. Feel a massive waterfall of unconditional love surrounding you in all directions and filling you. That's your angels making their presence known. Your angels want you to ask for what you want and for their help, and know you are always held. Friends, if you need help holding oneness energy, the highest vibration that is, I'm hosting a 3-week live oneness course starting March 1st. Register today at theangelmedium.com/shop. Or if you're ready to develop your gifts of mediumship, bringing through angel messages and energy healing all at once, sign up for my Angel Reiki School today at theangelmedium.com. Now, know that whatever resonates with you in today's episode is a message just for you from your angels. Today we have Elise Lunin on the show, and she's somebody that I admire so incredibly much. Friends, if you read Glennon Doyle's Untamed, you will love her book called On Our Best Behavior, The 7 Deadly Sins and the Price Women Pay to Be Good. For me, it was like reading it. It was almost as if I was going through 5 to 10 years of therapy, because you say things in way that we all feel it, but you're saying it through a new lens and a new perspective. And I think the way in which you write takes people back to their own experience in a very, very healing way.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So welcome to the show, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So when you go through the 7 deadly sins, and we can go through some of them in here, what I was finding too is not only do I feel that women are judged so much in our individual lives, but from my perspective, being raised in a very, very Catholic and then Christian home when my parents divorced, there was no room for women within the spiritual community as leaders. And when I was really, really young, and they would say, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? A priest, like no brainer priest. Well, you can't be that. Well, then you can be a nun. Well, if you're a nun, you can't have a family. Check that off the list, because I know I want a kid one day. There wasn't any room. And so now you have this massive group of women coming to the forefront as healers, teachers within the spiritual community. And yet so much of what you write in your book is still being thrown at female spiritual leaders to keep them in place. Have you seen that too?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm so glad you picked up the book, because I feel like people who, well, you've had your own journey with religion and spirituality, but I think people look at it and their immediate instinct is going to think is that it's a diatribe against religion, or it's condemning of religion wholesale, or condemning of men because it's about patriarchy. And it's none of those things. In some ways, what I wanted to understand, when we hear these big words like patriarchy and we sort of throw them around as boogeymen, or when we talk about the church, what are we even talking about? And whose interpretation are we listening to? Because the book, in a way, is about getting back to yourself, getting back to, you know, and I talk about how women are conditioned for goodness, men are conditioned for power, and that this goodness that I talk about is the culturally constructed goodness, the goodness that has been mediated for many of us by maybe it's a priest, maybe it's a parent, maybe it's a boss, maybe it's a professor, but these cultural constructs of what a good, quote unquote, good woman is, not goodness in its absolute value, which I believe is baked into every single one of us. It is God. It is who we are, essentially, and we become in our lives more and more distorted. And yes, women have gotten such a bad rap, and not from Jesus. The Old Testament is full of wonderful women as well. But yeah, and so women and this false patriarchal, the way that it's been whispered into culture, get a really raw deal. And you're probably a major Mary Magdalene fan, but that was one of the beginnings of this process for me.
Yes, yes. And the community that you're talking to right now is very, very spiritual. And we don't go into like the religious side here. We just kind of stay in that spiritual middle. But, you know, you talk about within the book, envy and greed, and really getting to the root of these two things. So I want to take them just one by one, because it's interesting. Do you ever have it, Elise? I love, we're 2 years apart, and we had a lot of similar experiences growing up, just kind of background direction of where we wanted to go. And you're just such a brilliant thinker of our time. I came to this conclusion. Do you ever have it where you're like being led by spirit down a rabbit hole of just figuring things out?
Oh, 100%. That was my whole book. Like the whole thing was like a wild romp with spirit, where I was, as I was going deeper into it, I was like, oh, and that, and that, and that. Like, I didn't even know at the beginning. I was like, I don't know why this is the punch list. That's the sins, which weren't even in the Bible, are the punch list of goodness for women. And then as I went into it, into the process, then I was able to trace it back to Mary Magdalene, et cetera. But 100%, I feel like I was taken by the hand and led through this book.
Oh, yeah. Well, sometimes that happens. And then I'll come to this epiphany moment, and then they'll bring me a book like this, and I'll be like, oh my God, same epiphanies.
Yes.
The epiphany that we need to be exploring what it is that we want, because we are told not to want, that it's bad, you're not that good girl if you have those wants, needs, and desires. However, the only true way to know your soul self is to know what it is that you want, because what it is that's within you, that's calling to you, those desires are often very much spirit led in a direction that it's not like material, but taking you to a place where you can serve humanity. And so by seeing those wants, needs, and desires, my God, can we step into a better version of ourselves?
Yeah. And yes, women are conditioned. And again, so much of this is not part of our conscious awareness. I wasn't aware, despite having a successful life, on paper, I wasn't aware of how deeply these sins lived in me. And I was not raised in a religious household like you, so I didn't get this programming directly. But yes, like this idea of wanting is so difficult for women. And I'm sure people who are listening are like, no, it's not that hard. And then, but I ask you, I go home and try and write down what you really want for yourself, the things that you have never said aloud to another person, but maybe haven't even acknowledged to yourself. This was a wall that I hit at the beginning of this process, where I was like, I honestly don't know. I am so used to subjugating what I want to other people's needs. I don't even think it's like I had an awakening of, this is what I want with my life and I can't make it happen. I don't think I ever even went through that process of saying, this is what I want, ever, never.
Right. Yeah. Because what I see from people is it's so ingrained that we don't even see it. And what that means is spirit can be bringing something through to someone, and you're immediately shutting it down and not allowing yourself to daydream on it or even entertain it, because you go, no, it's not possible. I have these obligations. It's not possible. So no, I'm not even going to think about it. And so here we are, like, promoting to society, especially women, manifest, co-create. And yet at the same time, we're not teaching them how to turn on those mechanisms within their brain to just keep, to do it, to actually do it.
Exactly. Because you can sort of pay lip service to it which is, you know, this the book is about this internalized patriarchy and the way that we can all sort of pay lip service or say, oh, yeah, I'm, you know, living my best life or whatever it is. And then when you start to evaluate those inner critic voices, when you start to evaluate the way that you are limiting yourself or have those limiting beliefs about what you can or should be doing, you recognize how alive it is in you. And yes, a big part of it is, I think, the call, the sort of daemon, the part of us that needs to be expressed, that is our individual gift. We are all distinctly abled. The, like, this is the reason. I mean, there can be many reasons that we're here, but the reason that we're here, what we're supposed to bring to the world, the contracts that we've made. And honestly, I think so often, and I don't know if this is a gendered thing, I'm sure men can relate to this as well, but we're taught that life is sort of hard for women, that there's so much labor, there's so much doing, there's so much energy that must be expressed, that sometimes what's easiest for us, what's most joyful for us, what feels light, we deprecate because it can't be that. It has to be hard and onerous. And so I think so many of us are also like, I love to bake. That's not my gift. That's not what I'm supposed to do. And it's like, well, maybe that is in some way what you're supposed to do. Like, this is, it's supposed to be joyful. It's supposed to be fun.
Explain deprecate.
Deprecate? The word?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, deprecating is just like essentially de-appreciating. It's like taking something and like slamming it. It's like taking it, depriving it of its value and, you know, making it worthless.
Interesting. I feel like, I don't know if I want to say epiphany or mic drop, but there was one of those like in each chapter as I'm going through, or maybe just every couple of pages. One of the things that you say in there, and I was like, wow, Elise, like that's so how I feel, is that we have these relationships with our moms that on one hand are very, very like close. I love my mom to death. I sometimes think about the day that'll be here in the future where she's not here, and it makes me so incredibly sad. But you talk about how in the book that our moms weren't really raised by caregiving people and they did the best with us that they could. But we got to a place in our 20s and our 30s where we got to do so much that they didn't get to do. And there was a jealousy, there was a resentment. Even though they wanted to keep pushing us to succeed and cheerleading us, it's a mixed bag of emotions to be a mom. And I think that helped me understand my own relationship with my mom better.
No, I think it's an essential conversation because, you know, and for context, and I don't think that my mom is probably dissimilar from most moms. And that's ultimately why I ended up telling so many stories about myself, which I was loath to do because honestly, I'm not that interesting. And what I really wanted to do was, you know, pull together thinkers, et cetera. But I needed to put myself in the book because I think so many of our stories are we stories, right? They are collective stories. We're all having very similar experiences as much as we've been conditioned to believe that we are completely separate from other people's experiences. So, you know, my mom, an incredibly competent, very smart woman who has spent her whole life in some ways feeling like she didn't live up to her potential. She was born in 1950, oldest of a large Catholic family, wasn't really mothered, as you were just saying, like hadn't had that experience. She did a lot of caretaking for her younger siblings and grew up in poverty, didn't have a lot of opportunity. But she came of age in second wave feminism, where there was all of this messaging about what was newly possible for women. And so it was kind of available, but kind of not. She probably could have made it happen, but she went to nursing school. Everyone went to nursing school. She married my dad, who's a physician, and chose what to her felt like safety, security, stability, which she'd never really had in her life. I completely understand that choice. But in that process, and I don't think that my dad actually mandated this in any way, she put everything else aside. Never really wanted to have kids. Wasn't her dream, but she had two kids.
Have you ever listened to the radio where the DJ calls listeners at random? That's what we're going to start to do here, only it's me calling you to give you a free angel reading. Starting now, I'm going to call and bring through messages for one new listener every week. But first, I need your phone number. To sign up, all you have to do is rate this podcast 5 stars and give me your contact info over at theangelmedium.com/gift. Look for my name popping up on your phone and get ready for messages from your angels. Want to watch me make those calls? Follow me on Instagram at Angel Podcast.
And she was a great mother, but she didn't have, because she'd never been mothered herself, she didn't have that energy for us. It was a different kind of caretaking. It wasn't maternal. And again, we load women with so many expectations about what it's supposed to look like. But yeah, growing up, what I'm so grateful to my mother for is that she was incredibly honest and she was always quite clear about her deep ambivalence about having children. So I never questioned her love for me or my brother, but I did question her love for her particular life trajectory, even though she could acknowledge that, like, it was pretty great and she's happy, more or less. But she was honest. And I think what happens to so many of us is that there's no conversation about this. There's no room for these types of conversations. And so it goes unsaid, but it's deeply felt by everyone in the house. And I think a lot of kids who don't have the explanation think it's them. And so I feel like she spared me from that. But she had deep envy about what I was allowed to do. And I think as women, we feel such a pull. Like, you don't want to usurp your mom. You don't necessarily want to replicate their life, but you don't want your life to be in some way a judgment on their life by not doing it. They did, or choosing something different. It's very different for boys and men.
Yeah. Where you say in the book, like, they're supposed to go school their dad on the basketball court.
Yeah. They're supposed to dunk on their dad. It's like a rite of passage, but doing that to your mother, feels wrong. And I think we're working this out generation to generation, but it's very loaded and very, I think, deeply felt by women. And I don't necessarily have an answer for it, except that I think the more that we can talk about it and normalize it and give it air, the less personal it starts to feel, the more structural, systemic it starts to feel. And I think it gives us a little bit more grace for each other and gives us room to really explore those relationships, which, as you said, it's like one of the most important relationships in your life. And there's so much shame. Obviously, every woman I know has shame about her mothering or how she was mothered. It's very heavy.
It is. And I have not made that easy on my own mom. But I want to go back to something that you said kind of when you started out the conversation, because I think this is a point too, where there are some teachers out there, and I think that you're a teacher. Like, I consider you to be, you're my teacher. They use their own stories. And I do this often within my own podcast, because sometimes I just can't recall something else that has not happened to me. But I wrote my second book last year. And as I'm kind of editing it now, people are saying, you do a really good job at teaching, Julie, but you got to put yourself in there. And then you get feedback sometimes from people who listen to the podcast, like, we don't want to hear about you. Okay, but then I don't know what other example to use to give to you. And I found it really, really helpful to hear all of the examples that you gave, because every single one, I was like, oh my God, Elise could be my best friend. Like, there's just everything was so similar that we went through, even though it was completely different experiences, you felt the same things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have two things. Well, first, in terms of podcast feedback, I mean, I'm sure you know this, but there's like the person who says more of you and then the person who says less of you, or I hate your voice, or you're the voice that talks me to sleep every night. And I think that, you know, we mentioned envy very quickly, but I think for a lot of people, at least when I read podcast reviews, I can sense envy, not necessarily. And let me just clarify, because we didn't go into this deeply, but
we can go into it. I loved what you said on envy. I mean, it's amazing.
Okay. It's important. And I think it's important for women because I think it's the genesis of so much women on women hate in our culture. And it started for me with this comment by psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb, who said that she always tells her clients to pay attention to their envy because it shows them what they want. And again, this is at the beginning of this process for me. And I had two reactions. The first was, ooh, envy, gross. Like, I don't have that. And two,
Oh, but we all do.
And two, like, I don't even know what I want. And then I realized that I could reverse engineer. I could identify my envy, or I could identify what I wanted actually by figuring out who in the culture I was having a response to that was, I don't like her. Who does she think she is? I have all this judgment and criticism of what she's doing. It's not necessarily fair, you know, or relevant. It's that energy of how dare she, who does she think she is, why her, and why not me? And that is rampant in our culture. And so I could very quickly start to identify, oh, I think I'm envious. I think she has something I want or is doing something that I want to do. She is pushing on a dream that I have for myself and showing me what I want. This is full of information for me. It has nothing to do with her. And so it's a really powerful tool because all the sins crash into each other. Pride and envy are very related. We're scared of being seen or celebrated for our gifts because we know it will inspire envy. And then we will get cut down like a tall poppy in a poppy field. This is the playbook for women, famous or otherwise. And it also crashes into scarcity for women, which is that there's only room for one. And if you have it, then I can't have it. And the only way for me to have it is to take it away from you or knock you off your throne. And men do not think like this. This is not in the programming for men. And this is why it's so much easier for them to support each other and help each other and ignore each other. So when I look at podcasts, sometimes there's great feedback in podcasts, like the ads are too loud or, you know, often there's good feedback. But when it's just sort of that, like, you talk about yourself too much or you don't, you know, and you're like, well, find another podcast, one. But second, it's like all I can hear in that is nobody wants to listen to me. Nobody wants to hear my stories. Why you and why not me? Like, all to me, I just want to, I mean, there's no way to respond to commenters on podcasts, but I want to just be like, start a podcast. I think you want to start a podcast. You should start a podcast. One, there's that. And then second, this idea of telling our stories. And I've been thinking about this a lot. I don't know if you've like encountered the idea of this cosmic egg. And I love the way that Richard Rohr, who I'm obsessed with, writes about the cosmic egg, but he talks about how sort of the cosmic egg is broken. And in the cosmic egg, you have the me story, which is nestled inside of the we story, which is nestled inside of the story. And as our culture has moved, has sort of abandoned all collective, communal, spiritual gathering. I mean, we're finding it in sort of small pockets. But as we've abandoned the big cultural uniting stories, we are a little bit shattered. And you're seeing a lot of me story that's not connected or interested in the we story or the story. And so I think when we sort of reorient or reassemble that cosmic egg for people where your story is in service to something that's bigger or speaks to a wider group of people that's part of a bigger story, I think it's a great, not even a great service. I think that's when it carries resonance. Because people see themselves in what you're saying. And it's not like, I mean, very few people have stories that are like Jeanette Walls, Glass Castle, you know, where you're eating out of a dumpster or you have such an amazing story that very few people can really relate to. But even then, I think there are always things to relate to. But I think that right now we're in a cultural moment where people are trying to distinguish themselves, their story is wholly unique. And I think that the more of us who can say, I think just like the rest of you in many ways, I think that's, there's a resonance and a reassurance in that that's really important and that unites and connects us.
Absolutely. And I think that that's always the mission of the story, is to take your story and show something that is that universal we and connects to the thee, so that we can all learn and grow together. Yeah.
And understand this project, you know, like we are all here, I believe, for some reason, to evolve, advance, grow, break ourselves, break each other, reassemble, get bigger, get stronger. And I think we're all looking for clues about how to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and going back to what you were saying about envy, I remember the very first time that I had that. I was a freshman in high school, and there was a senior in high school, Jenny, who was the editor of the school newspaper. And I was like, that's what I want. Like, that's what I want to do. But it wasn't like, I want to take that from her. I want to learn from her. I want to grow from her. I want to understand, you know, how to navigate this to get to that point. But it's interesting. As I kind of got into my 20s and 30s, I think it did shift to a, why does she have that and I don't? And that blocked me for a time in my life from being like, well, how do I actually get to that point? How did she do what she did? What steps did she take? And what skills does she have? What did she learn? What classes did she go through? And now I think once you learn that lesson, you can come at everything from that other perspective of, there's something I can go do to get to that point.
It's such an important perspective shift. And, you know, I write about, I don't know if you know Lacey Phillips, who does To Be Magnetic, which is sort of manifestation, but she does it with a neuroscientist. So it's also about like finding those limiting self-conscious beliefs that will never let you have what you want because you're convinced you don't deserve it. And exactly what you were saying is sort of one of her foundational themes, which is you take the people that you envy, really, and it could be something that's part of what of their experience. It could be the whole kit and caboodle, and you use them as an expander. And you'd say, you shift from judgment and sort of blame and anger to, okay, this person's my expander. I'm going to study them. I'm going to watch them. I'm going to sort of get in that same stream and see what happens. And it's a much more empowering and it's sweet. There's something really nice about it, which is, oh, if she can do that, I can do that too. Like, this is what's possible for me, rather than I am going to take her down.
Right. Yeah. Envy ties in to the greed piece, I think, a lot for women, because the men around me within my life were taught from an early age how to look at money, how to manage money, how to think about money, to let money grow itself. And, you know, we were even at a dinner party a couple of years ago, and my husband goes, don't talk about money, like in front of this other couple. And I was like, I'm going to talk about money, because women don't talk about money with one another, like another enough. And so we're not learning, we're not growing. And so bye-bye. We had a, you know, like nice conversation that night. No, that shouldn't be on the table.
Yes. It's such a disservice to women, this idea that really money is for men and that it's not polite to talk about money. It's unseemly and it's gross, because then it makes money base, gross, somehow deeply unspiritual. And that to want more of it or to feel like you need more of it is a failing. And I think that that sort of thinking has really set women back, because we talk about the pay gap, which obviously needs to be addressed, although there are so many nuances to the pay gap that we leave behind, which is, if you're a single white woman, chances are you're earning as much as your male counterpart. There's a huge tax against mothers, and there's a huge tax against women of color. When you start to sort of look at all of those tiers, that's where you really see the pay gap start to show up. But there's a wealth gap, which is actually 32 cents to the dollar. Women are so far behind men. And we're conditioned to see money as scarce, and as a finite pond, whereas men are more inclined to see it as a river. And I think that women also are sort of recognize what's happening in our world. We, as like these creative vessels, recognize that these things, like, I think we identify very intensively with the planet, right? As this maternal, life-giving entity that is bounded in some ways, that, you know, we can't just keep taking without killing her. So I think it's very complex. But where I see, where I want women to shift their thinking about money is to really get our hand, to sort of get fluent in it and get our hands around this idea of enough rather than scarcity, that wanting more is bad, base, and greedy. And I work with this woman who's sort of one of my spiritual guides, Krista Schumacher. I don't know if you've encountered Krista, but she's an amazing forensic medium who also channels Yeshua. I have learned so much from her. She's brilliant. She was a neuroscience major at Brown who channels Jesus. I mean, no big deal. This is, it's like exactly what you don't think it is. But then you go and you're like, of course, this is what it is. Like, this is funny and fun and joyful and also just like, whoa, like bombs of wisdom. But anyway, years ago, I was talking to Krista and I had left my job and I go into these, you know, part of it is my childhood programming. I go into these big scarcity vortex holes of like, I'm the primary breadwinner. I don't have enough. And she stopped me and said, okay, what do you need? And I was like, I don't know. I just know I don't have enough. I just need more. She was like, this is what I encounter in every conversation like this. I promise you, the divine is very good at serving needs, not always material wants, but needs. Make it concrete. You need to understand what you need and what you want. In that sense, that's fine. No shame. Do not have shame. There's no shame. But like, tell me what you need. Like, you need to actually articulate what you need. You'll be shocked at how the universe will meet you. And it's true. I have, in the 4 years since we did that exercise where I just made a Google Doc, figured it out, wrote it down, came up with a number. And I was like, oh, I can do this. One, it just calmed my nervous system down to actually have a number. And I was talking to a friend who's also sort of in the spiritual community, and she had done a similar exercise, which involved also wants. Like, do you want a house? Do you want to pay off your college loans? Like, you write it all down and then you write yourself a check. There's like a blank check and you have to write the number down. She just said it was like one of the hardest exercises she had ever done. It's really interesting, actually, how difficult this exercise is for women and how much shame, anxiety, and feelings of badness are wrapped up in it.
It's interesting because I think what ends up happening is there are things that we want, and this is very much a process. Like, this just doesn't happen. Sometimes this has been like years of work to get to a certain place for me personally in my life. And then I catch myself still holding myself back in certain ways. I've wanted to do this TV show. We've got this concept. It's kind of gone through some different iterations over the years. And now we've got it to like this just beautiful way to do this show. We've got like the right people, I think, kind of connected to it. We're missing a couple of key players, but I keep self-sabotaging in some areas. And I keep having to go back to, no, I really do want this. This can really happen. Stop self-sabotaging. Like, just go for it if this is what you really want.
And do you think it is what you really want?
Oh, there's that piece that's there for all of us mamas of like, this is going to be a lot more work than I thought it was going to be. It's like when you're daydreaming about it. Oh, you know, Ryan's PB show.
So fun. Yeah.
So easy. Yeah. Anybody can do it. It's so hard. There's so many pieces and it's very, very complex and it's very, very time consuming. But yeah, no, it is what I want.
Yeah. I mean, so many of us, I think also, I was just recording a solo episode on my podcast about this idea too, where I think particularly those of us who work for ourselves now or have sort of an or are creatives or in this space. Well, I think it's true of anyone, particularly as like more and more people are consulting or part-time contract work or whatever it may look like, that it becomes really easy to find yourself being dragged by the cart rather than driving the cart because you feel like an opportunity comes into your lap or you try to make something happen without really thinking through, like, again, is this what I want? And do I have the energy, the resonance, the vibration to manage this? Or is this going to run away with me? And I think too, within spiritual communities, I was talking about this with a friend who's a Jungian, and Carl Jung wrote so much about synchronicity and the I Ching. And I mean, anyone, all of us, right, are constantly sort of reading the weather, like the GPS of the universe or spirit. And it can be so easy to say, oh, this fell into my lap. Therefore, this is what I'm supposed to do. And to look at all synchronicity or everything that comes together as somehow a push from beyond. But sometimes they're tests, you know, and sometimes I think they're prompts to say, what do you really want? And I think that I have friends where sometimes I'm like, I think you're not learning the lesson that easier isn't better. You know, sometimes it's like important within the concept of synchronicity or wanting to also understand your own patterning and your own preferences. Because sometimes I feel like these come to us as tests to say, this is what you've always done and it's not working. So you need to do something different. And we're going to keep testing you until you do something different.
And does that mean to you, like, kind of letting go of the dream? Because sometimes there are things that we just find that we don't have capacity for. And we get to a place where we're like, wow, I really thought I wanted this, but it's Wizard of Oz. I just peek behind the curtain and it's not really what I want.
I think that can happen. But I think mostly when you're really conscious about what you want to create and what you want to do, that's what's required. What I'm talking about is more like, I have friends who have had higher powered careers. Like, I'm thinking of one friend in particular who has had sort of like not an easy time of it, but is one of those people who can just sort of snap. She's had like, I don't know what's happening in her chart, but she's had a long period of just like abundance and ease and finger snapping, which is rare. And that has run out. It's clear to the rest of us that that ran out a while ago. And that in this phase of her life, not that she can't be equally successful, but that she has to do things differently. She's still in that mindset of, oh, this person just happened to want to do the same thing as me. So like, here's our 5-year plan. And like, we're doing it. And it's like, no, I think you're missing the message. So it's more that, because I think that for her, she hasn't committed to doing the work of going to the mat and being like, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm here for. It's more for her, I think, about reascending to like her level of power and whatnot, and not about like consciously saying, okay, as Elise, this is what I'm trying to make. I'm going to avoid everything that's trying to pull me out of what I want to do and like really just give myself to what I want.
What does that process look like in you? Because as I was reading your book, I was like, I really want to ask her this. So I have to go down, or I just went down to the expedited passport office. I got this opportunity, this business trip. I get to go over to Spain and I'm going through my stuff. And my husband put in like our little storage area, this document or this folder that my mom sent up of just like different things she saved from my childhood. And in there was a letter or receipt that she had taken to the mailbox and mailed to like one of the Teeny Bopper magazines at the time in New York City, like circa 1998, right? Like I wanted to be a little contributor.
Like a sassy or YM like columnist?
Yes. 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 And you did it. Like you went to New York, you got a job at Lucky Magazine, you got an entry level and you figured out like, how can I make myself invaluable here and work my way up? Has it changed? And maybe I won't like add this into the podcast, but how do you actually get to write for people today?
In some ways, it hasn't changed. It's interesting. It's when I took my first, got my first job and the economy sucked. I mean, I feel like it's the constant story, right? But it was right after 9/11. I was so desperate for a job. It took me a long time to find a job. It was scary. I got a job at Lucky. I was a freelance editorial assistant doing like not glorious work, but I just knew, I was like, if I can show that I can be entrusted with hacking up samples and doing running sweepstakes rules past the legal team and no job too small, then I can create some safety here. I can create some security. And invariably it worked. You know, people trusted me. They knew I would do it. I was responsible and resourceful. And then they gave me more and more. They gave me bigger jobs and until they needed to hire someone underneath me because I couldn't do all of it. And I didn't know at that point sort of what I wanted. Again, going back to this theme, just more that I needed safety and security, and I wanted a job and I wanted that level of protection, it felt like, in the world. But here's the thing I've learned is every time, and I felt this way, I sort of grew up, you know, went up the masthead at various Condé Nast magazines. I started a section, like a 14-page section at Time Out New York. I went back to Condé Nast. My last job there was like at the top of the masthead at Condé Nast Traveler. And then I left to go and work at a big internet company because I knew if I didn't know about the internet, I really wouldn't have a career. And then when I went to Goop, it was, in some ways, it was this very tiny team. It was tiny and not at all the company or brand that it is today. And I was 22. It was like being 22. It was really fun, but I was doing this like deeply in glory. I was doing all of it. And it's funny, I'm doing a big consulting project too, because I can't sort of, I have six jobs now that I work for myself. But that's the truth. This is the reality. Like, it's hard. It's hard to make it as a writer, certainly. And I was doing some work for a client, it's a consultant. And I was like, here I am, 22 again, writing product captions. Like, in so many ways, you never really, and maybe this is my own failing, but I think it's like kept me close to the work. I think it keeps me close to sort of what I'm making. And I think of it as art and commerce. That's been important for me. I think for any creative who's listening, I've gotten much better after ghostwriting 12 books for other people and finally writing my own book, Honor Best Behavior, which was my 13th, lucky number 13, the goddess number. But that now I'm where I find is like there's the stuff that I will always keep for myself, my own ideas, and I will stand behind those. And it took me a long time to sort of come out of the shadows as a ghostwriter. And then there's the stuff that's for commerce that helps me support myself. And that's the stuff that's not as meaningful to me, but that allows me to write the books I want to do.
Well, it was just interesting because I looked at that piece of paper that I found in the safety box and I was like, oh my goodness. Like, I had that dream. I sent in that one letter, didn't hear back, and totally gave up. And you just have to keep going sometimes and opening up different doors. You have this beautiful point in the book where you talk about at the beginning that there's this story of the two wings, that there's the male wing and the female wing. Can you tell everybody that?
Yeah. I heard this from Lynn Twist too. And speaking of scarcity, I love her book, The Soul of Money. It's very beautiful. I think that's required reading, particularly for women. She had originally told it, I think it's part of the Baha'i faith and it's their story and it's a prophecy. It's one of those stories as I was like trying to fact check it and trace it back. I couldn't figure out where it started, but it was this prophecy that humanity right now is a crooked, a sort of malformed bird in some ways, that the feminine wing has not been fully extended. And so the male wing has a sort of like caught, we're in a spiral where we're not really able to move forward or fly straight. And then in this century, in this moment, the feminine is finally extending and strengthening in each of us, regardless of gender and in our culture at large. And that as we bring the polarity, these energies into balance, that we will start to be able to actually functionally fly. It feels so important to me. And I write a lot about sort of the masculine and the feminine, which I'm sure is familiar to everyone who's listening. you know, I think women for the most part are quite comfortable with both, you know, and I think for men, they desperately need to let their feminine come up and all that energy that's about nurturance and creativity and care, not only so that they more fully share that load with us and for the culture at large, but for themselves. I think as we start to sort of rebalance ourselves, we'll start to rebalance the world.
Incredible. Elise, your book is On Our Best Behavior. We'll put where everybody can get it in the show notes. If you want to share where everybody can find you, we can put that in the notes too.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. So I write a weekly newsletter, EliseLunan.substack.com. And then I have a weekly new podcast as well called Pulling the Thread. And there's probably quite a synergy between our audiences. It's about big questions of the day, lots of spirituality, culture, I, you know, run the gamut. And then I'm on Instagram at Elise Lunan, and that's it.
I love you on Instagram. I love your words of the day. I love your insights. I'm a total book nerd, and I love that you share all of the books. You have a page on your website, too, where you're like, these are my favorite books in every category.
And category?
I read through that, and I go, add that to my manifestation board. One day, not yet. First book isn't good enough, but one day my book will be on Elise's list.
Book? Send me your books. I need your books.
Oh, this is amazing. Elise, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Oh, I want everybody to know one thing too. Lunan is spelled L-O-E-H-N-E-N, just so that you can find her everywhere. Yes.
I know. Tough last name.
Me too. I was Harris before. And now I'm Jancis. So I get it.
Yeah. I mean, my husband's Bismar. It's not that much easier.
Okay.
So I just kept my old name.
That's awesome. Friends, your angels asked me to do a little teaching here at the end of each episode in February about manifestation, because they say that when it comes to you co-creating within your own life, you're missing a step. That 98% of humanity is missing this step. So they want to give it to you. But first, I want to let you know something. I wish I would have called the Angel Reiki School the Angel Reiki Mediumship School, but that name was too long, right? Friends, the Angel Reiki School is not just a place where you learn Reiki energy healing. In fact, it's really not about learning energy healing at all. The Angel Reiki School is the place where you go to develop your gifts in mediumship, being able to bring through angel messages from the angels to other people, to learn Reiki and other energy healing modalities, and to learn how to, if you want, don't have to. A lot of people come through the Angel Reiki School simply to build out their gifts, to understand their gifts, develop their God-given, unique spiritual gifts to the max. But a lot of people also come through the Angel Reiki School to develop a business of their own and to get that certification so that they know what they're doing when they're working with other people. Friends, an entire new class of the Angel Reiki School begins March 1st online. If you are looking to go through the Angel Reiki School, now is the time. Sign up for a discovery call with me. The link is in the show notes below. I'm going to help you get where you want to be as a healer or with your own unique spiritual gifts in the Angel Reiki School. All right, friends, here is the deal. When it comes to manifestation, Spirit is saying right now, they just keep flooding in this message that 98% of humanity looks to manifest, right? Like they want to manifest something. They know that they want to go in a direction. They get that clarity on that direction. They create the vision board. They see it within their mind. They're visioning it within their mind. And then they stop. That's where their efforts stop. And the angels say there is a huge piece to this puzzle that you are missing. So that piece is when you vision, you have this clarity, I want to do X. You get the vision, you create the vision board, whatnot. it doesn't stop there. That's when we activate our intuition even more. Prayer as well. The angels always say prayer and intuition are really the same thing. They're both forms of communication with the other side. And when you activate that intuition, you're asking God, universe, source, what's the next step for me? What's this first step that I need to take in order to work towards this goal that I have for myself, my life, my family, my career, whatever it may be? And as you pray, you hear something back from the other side. And it's just a first step, all right? And when you hear this first step, what a lot of people do is ask the other side for more signs. We ask for like complete clarity, but it really is this first step that, you know, okay, we pray, we hear this back, do this. That first thing that we're supposed to go do is something that we choose to do or not with our own free will. So if you go act on it and you go do that one thing, what happens? As you're in the energy of actually doing what spirit asked you to do, you get the next piece of the puzzle. But you cannot get that next piece to the puzzle unless you take the first step. You pray, you hear back, go do this. And you're like hemming and hawing, do I do it? Do I not? Do I do it? Do I not? Go do it. Your angels say, go do it. Because when you do it energetically, it opens you up to the next step after that. And when you take action on that next step, it opens you up to the next step after that. This is what I mean when I say that some people are either crawling, walking, or running with God, universe, source. For some people, it takes them 6 months to get up the courage to go do that one thing that they're hearing back in their prayers. Go do this. It takes them 6 months to have the courage to go do that. For some people, it takes an entire year. For some people, it takes 10 years for them to get the courage to go do that one thing. And then we look around, right? And I'm not blaming or shaming anybody. I'm just trying to give you an example so that the angels can communicate with you better. What happens is then we look around when things aren't happening for us and we go, why? God, why? Why isn't it happening for me? Why aren't things coming through for me? Because you are crawling with God. And sometimes we're not even moving. We're not even taking that first step. There are some people who learn, all right, I'm going to go in this direction. I've got this clarity. I want to write a book. Okay, God, universe, source, I've got the vision. I want to write the book. What's my first step? And the angels come in and say, or God, universe comes in as you're praying and says, go read this other book. Go take this class. Go talk to this person you know. Go send this email. Go ask this question. Go research this. And you go to yourself within your own mind. You go, nope, that's not the answer. And so you delay. There are some people who don't do that. There are some people when they get that prayer within their mind, that answer within their mind, they go, all right, I'm going to go do that. I'm going to go read that book. I'm going to go talk to that person. I'm going to go ask that question. I'm going to go send that email. I'm going to go make that phone call. And as soon as they do, they're in a new energy as they're taking the action. And as they're taking the action and they're in this new energy, they get a new piece of information. And they go, okay, God, what do I do now? And God, universe, source goes, go do this. So they go do it. And then they get to that next piece and they go, what do I do now? And they hear back through their prayers, go do this. And so they go do that. Friends, this is where people start running with God, universe, source. So 5 times a day, 10 times a day, 100 times a week, they're following God's directives. They're not hemming and hawing. They're just following the loving, positive messages that they're receiving through their prayers, through their intuition. And so when I look at the energy of a person who goes, Julie, why isn't it happening for me? Versus other people who are running with spirit, what you're seeing is actually a mathematical number. of these are how many directives one person has gotten from God, universe, source that they followed through on. And this other person over here has followed through on 5,000 within 1 year, whereas another person is waiting to take action on one. And again, friends, I'm not blaming, shaming, trying to create a negative energy within you at all. I'm trying to show you what happens when you're living a spiritual life and running with spirit. So I know this is a long enough intro. Listen to it a couple of times. I'm only going to leave it up in February. And I want you to pause right now, and I want you to tune in, and I want you to pray. And I want you to say, God, universe, source, what's my goal? Where am I going? And once you have clarity on that, ask, what's the first thing I need to take action on? What's the first thing I need to do? Go do that, friends. That is going to help you run with your angels. And it is going to take you to living a life far beyond your wildest dreams. You're going to be shocked. And I want you to write into me, and I want you to let me know when you start to see a difference in your life because you're following this method. I love you so much, friends. Have a beautiful, beautiful, blessed day. And I'll see you back here this week. Love you.